UK Wine Show, show number 118. UK Vineyard Guide with Stephen Skelton. On this week's show, we're talking with Stephen Skelton on his new book, UK Vineyard Guide.
And in the news, Chapel Down joins forces with celebrity chef and E-Tongue to rival human wine tasters.
G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 118 for the 5th of August 2008. My name is Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Stephen Skelton on his new book, The UK Vineyard Guide. Stephen is an MW and in the past has grown grapes in the UK. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Constellation Brands is looking to sell 3 of its 10 wineries in Australia following a strategic review of its Australian business. As well as selling off the wineries, the company plans to consolidate its bottling operations, sell off more than 20 of its vineyard properties, and scrap more than 30% of its production lines. And up to 350 employees will lose their jobs as a result of the move. The US-based wine company, whose best-known Australian brands include Hardy's and Banrock Station, will increase the focus on its higher-priced wine brands and eliminate less profitable lines to improve margins. CEO Rob Sands says the project is part of ongoing efforts to enhance operating efficiencies, improve cash flow and return on invested capital, and reduce existing borrowings.
It wasn't that long ago, I think 2003, that BRL Hardy's was acquired by Constellation to become the world's largest wine company. For me, the question is, why are they getting rid of the wineries? Is it rationalisation? It could be that they're taking an opportunity of higher grape prices to offload their assets, especially given that the shortage of grapes in Australia has boosted the value of grapes, even though volumes are down a bit. But many of the big wine brands don't necessarily own most of their own grapes. It could simply be attempting to shift the risk of grape ownership to the smaller producers. I'm not sure if it's good news or bad news, but certainly smaller crops mean that Australia can't export as much wine as they have in the past. According to the Wine and Brandy Corporation, exports for the year to July 2008 were down 13% to 703 million litres, and value dropped by 12% to 2.64 billion Australian dollars compared to the year before. What's up next, Jane?
Well, an electronic tongue that can identify different wines has just been unveiled by scientists at Barcelona's Institute of Microelectronics and may be used as a new weapon in the battle against wine fraud. The device is based on similar principles to the human tongue and is sensitive to 5 different tastes of sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami, the savoury one. The technology uses a silicon chip called a microsensor with tiny synthetic membranes attached. Each membrane detects a different chemical component of the liquid that, when combined, make up the distinct characteristics of each grape varietal. So far, the device can only distinguish between 4, Chardonnay and the Spanish grapes Aran, Malvasia and Macabeo. It can also distinguish between a 2005 vintage and a 2004. Probably the commercial value of the E-Tongue lies in weeding out fraudulent fine wines at auction houses by verifying the vintage, but also it could help to enforce quality standards in winemaking by verifying that a wine has been made from the proper grapes. It's unlikely, though, that the device will make the human tongue redundant when it comes to tasting wine, because unfortunately it can't tell you whether your wine is worth drinking.
Cheers. I really like the idea of this. Not for fraud protection or even working out what's in the wine, although that could have been useful in Italy earlier in the year. But while the technology only looks at the basic structural elements in your mouth, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, it could be used to detect flavour compounds in the future. And then it would be very useful for winemakers to be able to pick the wines on flavour. For the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about terroir and picking wines on flavour, etc. And I could see this removing some of that guesswork. What's last, Jane?
Our final story this week is that one of England's top wine producers, Chapel Down, has joined forces with celebrity TV chef Richard Phillips to launch a restaurant at their vineyard in Tenterden, Kent. The restaurant is called Richard Phillips at Chapel Down and is the product of £1 million investment, combining state-of-the-art kitchen facilities with a fabulous dining experience in stunning surroundings. The focus will be on great British cooking with local produce and premium English wines, although the wine list does feature a large selection of wines from around the world. Richard already runs two highly successful restaurants with Thackeray's in Tunbridge Wells and the Hengist at Aylesford, and can be seen regularly on Ready Steady Cook and ITV's Daily Cooks. That's all from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories on our website www.3050.co.uk.
Yeehaw! At last, some of England's biggest wineries are going upmarket with food at last. Good on them. Up till now, the only restaurant come winery I was aware of in the UK was from Denby's, which I'm going to go have lunch there in about a week's time. Speaking of English vineyards, next up we have The Spotlight, which is a book review of Stephen Skelton's latest book, UK Vineyard Guide. Stephen Skelton's latest book, UK Vineyard Guide 2008, builds on his previous works, The Wines of Britain and Ireland. According to Stephen, he has attempted in this latest book to provide a reference to every vineyard in the UK. As with all books, the question is, what is the book for? This book is a no-holds-barred reference book, and it does it very well. The book is divided into two parts. The first part gives a history of viticulture in the British Isles and the structure of English viticulture, including tables on production and area under vine. Part 2 is an A to Z listing of every vineyard in the UK. In part 1, the history is divided up into three chapters. Chapters 1 is pre-Roman times to 1939. Then chapter 2 looks at the 1939 to 1951 revival, where English viticulture was born again. And finally, modern English winemaking from 1952 onwards. Chapters 4 and 5 look at English regional vineyards associations, which manage English wine. Chapter 6 gives a good overview of viticulture and vinification, including root selection, trellising, and equipment. Chapter 7 gives a great overview of varieties, with some excellent statistics on grape planting. There's also some very unusual statistics. For example, the top planted grape variety in the UK in 2007 was Pinot Noir. Chapter 8 gives a very good set of descriptions of grapes grown in England, particularly varieties that are only really grown in England, and the information can be missing or very thin in other reference books. Part 2, the UK Vineyard Guide, has a full set of lists of vineyards in alphabetical order, which to me is an improvement compared to his listings by region that he had for the last incarnation of the book. I find this much more useful to find wineries, and if you want to know a winery in your area, there is an index which lists vineyards by county at the beginning of Part 2. The descriptors for the vineyards can range from very brief to quite extensive, but this is in keeping with the size and commercial interests of the vineyards. And at the very least, he gives contact details, main varieties grown, and the size of the vineyard. In the fullest descriptions, they can give a complete history and context within the rest of the UK viticultural scene. The final section is an appendix, and here Stephen has added an unusual range of information from historical awards to how Christopher Merritt wrote in the Royal Society in 1662 how English coopers added sugar and molasses to make sparkling wines, a full 6 years before Dom Perignon, widely touted as by the French as the inventor of sparkling wines, arrived at the Abbey. What I like about the book is perhaps the best and most up-to-date set of statistics on English wine, whether it's on varieties, winery sizes, or yields. Stephen has it all. It also has a very thorough, if long, and at times tedious, history of the UK wines. To me, though, the book lacks maps and any discussion on geology or climate, which would be very useful. Nor does Stephen pass any comments on the quality of the wines produced from those listed in the books. While I can see the reason for missing comments about quality, as he needs a good working relationship with the wineries to get the statistics from them, but he could have easily done more on climate and soils. So while the index is of vineyards is great and there's some fantastic information in the book, some sort of way of deciding whether to visit a winery would have been useful. My other gripe is that much of part one text has been lifted from his previous book, Wines of Britain and Ireland, so I'd already read it before. But in conclusion, if you're into English and UK wine and do not own an earlier book, Wines of Britain and Ireland, then this really is an essential reference book. It has some great statistics, backgrounding information, and a superb index of all wine producers. If you have the earlier work and you're not so interested in statistics, then you could consider missing this version and picking up another edition in a couple of years. Personally, I have the previous version, and I'm very happy with this book. And it'll be in my bookshelf, and I'll be referring to it regularly. I rated this book in the end 83 out of 100. But next up, we talk with Stephen about his new book and get an overview of English wine from one of the most respected authorities on English wine. In the interview, we talk about the book, but more importantly, Stephen gives us his overview of the state of play on the UK wine scene. Hi, I'm here with Stephen Skelton, master wine and English wine expert. How are you, Stephen?
I'm very well, thanks. Very well.
Excellent. You started out growing grapes for Chapel Down, or before it was called Chapel Down?
Well, no, the vineyard I own has now become Chapel Down. Yeah, no, we started that in 76, so a long while ago now, 34 years.
Yeah, it's a fair old time being in trade. You've seen a lot of changes.
Quite a few.
Excellent. But what we're going to be talking about today is your new wine book, which is going to be released, well, should be about the same time as the show's going out, which is...
Yeah, well, sort of, I hope mid-June.
Mid-June. So we'll see. If the show goes out in December, we'll know you missed your deadline.
I'm sort of at the top of the hill, and I can see the bottom, so we're you know, almost ham and dry on it.
Fantastic. What's the book called?
Well, it's the UK Vineyards Guide, 2008, but it's an update, really, of the previous two books I've written, which follows the same format.
Yep.
The front section is a sort of historical, plus what we're doing today, viticulture, vinification, grape varieties, some statistics about wine production and so forth. Then in the back, there's all the vineyards listed. I think I've got 360 vineyards listed, and a little bit of information about most of them, and obviously all the contact details, addresses and so forth of the others.
Okay, I've got a copy of the old one. When was that?
The 01.
I noticed...
And that was written really in 99, so it's 7 or 8 years sort of out of date, really.
It is out of date.
Yeah. Well, a lot of vineyards, unfortunately, have disappeared. A lot of new ones as well.
Sure. And also, there's been a big stylistic change in the wines produced.
There has, yes. The area of the old varieties, you know, things like Müller-Thurgau, Bacchus, Hux-Arabe, Reicherstein and Madeleine Langevin, those sort of stalwarts have diminished. And varieties, obviously, such as Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, have come to the top. Those two are now occupying, I estimate, about 40% of the UK's 1,250 hectares, and are number one and number two varieties, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Julia from English Wine Producers, the marketing body for it, said that you've got better statistics than they have on what's out there.
Well, I've got better statistics than the Wine Standards Board, I think, because they only collect them every 3 years, and a lot can happen in 3 years.
Sure.
And I've got contacts with the people who are doing the planting, so I know what's going in roughly this year, 2008, so which wouldn't appear on the radar from the official point of view for at least a couple of years.
So what is going in this year?
Well, it's, you know, again, we've got mainly, but not only, but mainly Pinot Noir and Chardonnay for sparkling. A bit of Pinot Meunier, some Pinot Blanc, some Auxerrois. There's a bit of Bacchus, a bit of Riesling. There's a few smaller people doing the odd varieties, the old varieties maybe, that they'll try. Quite a few reds. People are still plugging away with these red varieties, things like Regent and Rondo and Dornfelder, Dunkelfelder. Pinot Noir, obviously, as well for reds, which I think is very successful because you can use it for red, rosé or sparkling, depending on the weather and the year.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people doing, in terms of sheer numbers, there's lots of vineyards, new vineyards, which are doing sort of smaller operations and a few much bigger ones.
The average UK acreage I saw was something like 2.5 acres or hectares?
Well, average size, you know, averages are meaningless, really. It's a spread that counts. I mean, there's probably 100 vineyards under 5 acres, and then another 100 sort of between 5 and 10, and then another... 50 sort of, and then there's about 50 really big ones, or 25 really big ones, and 25 sort of not quite so big ones.
Sure. Have you seen in the last 10 years since your last update that some vineyards are starting to get quite big? Because you look at things like Nye Timber with Eric's.
Well, you've got the big sort of 3/4. I mean, Nye Timber, Denbys, Chapel Down, to a certain extent. Three choirs are all much of the same, so 250 acres, 100 plus hectares. Ridgeview, sorry, I didn't mention those as well. So they're all pulling on, they will be. A lot of those vineyards are still young. I mean, Chapel Down has just bought 80 acres, so 32 hectares to plant, which won't, obviously, if they plant it this year, 08, they won't be cropping off it for another, the product won't be coming from it for another 5 years.
Sure.
But Nye Timber will be the first with serious volumes, followed by Ridgeview. Three choirs have a slightly different. They're sort of a slightly different organisation. They're not majoring so much on sparkling.
Yep.
They've still got a pretty strong presence in still wines of varying varieties. As have Denbys as well.
Do you, do you think that the English wine scene is changing completely to a sparkling style?
Not completely. I think there will still be a big presence of still wines. A lot of it sold by the producers from their farm gate to local outlets. I think the wine trade will more and more adopt sparkling as the standard English wine, with perhaps Bacchus being the only still wine they're really serious about.
Yeah.
And certainly from today's tasting, I thought the Bacchus wines, some of those showed up very, very well. You know, some of the sparklings were excellent, some of the sparklings were not so excellent, which is the way it goes. But we've still got work to do. We're not out of, we're not in the broad uplands yet of every year's a good year. You know, we had last year was 2007 was not a good year.
Volume-wise, or what about quality?
Volume-wise, it wasn't very hot, and quality-wise, it wasn't very good. You know, it was a cool, overcast vintage with poor flowering, which cut the volumes, and the acidities were just very difficult to get right.
Yeah,
because it was cool in the autumn.
Yeah, and there was a lot of disease pressure.
Disease as well, but cut the volume. Yeah,
excellent. What do you think going forward, looking into the future, if you had a crystal ball of maybe 10 to 20 years into the future?
Well, you'd like to think that the serious players, who will by then have volume, will be occupying regular slots, regular facings in the major multiples, which is where the bulk of the nation's wine is sold.
Sure.
You know, I would like to think that all the major multiples, the five of them, or however many is left by then, you know, will have two, three, four sparkling wines on every shelf, eye level, throughout all their branches. Probably not going to happen, but, you know, we might get somewhere close to it. I mean, yep. Things like, you know, there are some interesting things going on there. I mean, I know that, you know, Marks & Spencer's, Tesco's are all looking. Those Waitrose, I'm planting a vineyard for them next year.
That's right.
So that's a very interesting, because they're aiming to double their stores, double their shelf space, double the number of stores in 10 years. So they'll go from 170 branches to 350. It's good, and they're very, very much in the southeast, where most of the interest in English wine lies. You know, the southeast of the country. That's Waitrose's heartland, really.
Sure. Do you think there's going to be any consolidation? Because there's lots of small vineyards. Do you think they'll consolidate, or do you think they'll just...
Do you know, they'll come and go like they always have. Of my 1989 book, which had 350-odd vineyards in it, only 66 remain today. One book, only half of the 250 are still remaining, and of this new book, of my 350-odd, half of those are new since 01. So, you know, there's a lot of vineyards have gone under have disappeared in the last 20 years, a lot.
When you look at sort of the historical number of vineyards, there seemed to be a peak around the early 90s.
Yes, yeah.
What happened to the English wine scene after that? Why was there a peak then and it dropped away?
I think it was, you know, during the sort of late 70s and 80s, we started selling wine in 79. Up until about the mid-80s, end of the 80s, I mean, I took over at Lamberhurst in 88, so I was the winemaker there till 91. We were selling, you know, quite serious quantities into the trade, and then suddenly things changed. You know, the old sort of Germanic varieties got a bit of a knocking. We were getting, you know, the Australian wines were coming onto the market, New Zealand wines, Chilean wines. The whole wine scene was changing, and the old style German wines were getting less and less shelf space. And English wine came under pressure, you know, and suddenly people realised that there were different styles out there, and they preferred those Australian styles, Jacob's Creek and that sort of, you know, product. And a lot of people just couldn't market the wine they were producing. Some people had planted quite big acreages. You know, there was Andy Vining Wello had got, I think, 80 acres or thereabouts. Barkham Manor was about 50 acres, you know, and they just could not cope with the marketing of that style of wine. And so a bit of a depression in the fun, you know, economically turned down, and people started grabbing grapes. You know, you can't keep stacking up vintages, especially if it's still wine. You know, people want, you know, there's a lot of interest in the sort of, there's a couple of 07s on the table today. You know, everyone wants to taste them. What do they taste like? You know, it's the new vintage. But in the sparklings, of course, everyone's saying, oh, 2001, oh, that's, you know, got a bit of age to it. Let's try that. Could be quite good. You know, age is actually a benefit in sparkling wine.
Sure.
And that makes a great deal of difference to your marketing, you know.
Do you think that gives them flexibility?
Well, it gives them flexibility. It also, of course, means you have a lot more money tied up.
Yeah.
You know, for every year that you have to extra age it, you've got a year without sales.
Yep.
You've got a year of, you know, bottles, concrete, air conditioning, crates. I mean, you know, it's all expense. So it puts a strain on the capital, but it does allow you perhaps to get into your marketing slightly more easily. But when you've got still wine, when you've got vintage after vintage stacking up, you're not selling it, you've got a big vineyard, you know, you've only got two options, really. You know, what you do, slash the price, try and get rid of it, cut the production, that's always difficult. It's a very difficult thing to do if you've got a lot of still wine, you know, trying to find a market for it.
So do you think the current expansion of the English wines at the moment is a function that they've found another product that the market wants?
They think the market wants it.
Yeah, because
the market's been taking, you know, Knight Timber is still only producing 35,000-40,000 bottles a year. Yeah. Ridgeview is about the same. When they go to 10 times that, 20 times that, will the market be there? This is the unknown. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, there's a big, you know, sparkling wine. Yeah, sparkling wine. You know, we are the biggest export market for champagne. We're the biggest export market for cava. We're the biggest export market for a number of sparkling wines. You know, we drink a lot of sparkling. We're a lot of us. And we drink a lot of sparkling wine, and you can read various. I mean, I heard champagne sales were up 40% last year. I think that's probably a lie, but
24% well, in the UK.
Yeah, in the UK. Yeah, I think we're probably, you know, there's probably sort of 10-15% you know, increase in sparkling wine sales, which, when you look at the number of bottles, is far more than the English wine producers are ever producing.
Sure.
So, I think we could get into that market, but we've got to have quality on the product, quality on the packaging, quality operations in terms of fulfilling what retailers and wholesalers want out of you in terms of deliveries and all that that goes with it. You know, life today, I'm afraid, is too short to be faffing about with the suppliers who don't, you know, fulfill what you want. They want an they order wine, it's got to be there.
Yeah, sure.
Packaged properly, delivered properly, safely, next day virtually. And that's what suppliers want. A lot of small growers are not cut out for that.
Have you had a look at, obviously, in your time, you know the economics of vineyards quite well. A lot of English whites and reds come in around, say, £8 to £11 price point. Is that a profitable price point? Because the climate means you're not going to get big crops.
You can't say what's a profitable price point. You can't say. It's very, very difficult to, you naturally try and make as much money as you want. You charge what the market will bear. If the market would take £20 a bottle for all the sparkling wine made, then that's what people would charge.
Yep.
You know, they will adjust their prices accordingly. People often say, well, English wine's expensive, isn't it? Well, it depends what you're comparing it to. I mean, it's not expensive compared to Tavel Rosé, which sells for phenomenal amounts of money, or good Sancerre, or top champagnes. But it is expensive compared to cheap bulk wines from countries which can make cheap bulk wines. But, you know, if you priced every bottle you'd ever made at £1, you wouldn't have any left. Priced it at £50, you'd have every bottle you ever made left. So, you know, you pitch your price according to your perceived demand and your supply. And as supplies increase, you tend to be slightly more relaxed about discounts and so forth, and vice versa. English wine is the price it is, full stop.
Do you think...
if you don't want to buy it, don't buy it. I mean, if people didn't buy it, it wouldn't be this price.
For sure.
Yeah. And you have to manage your stocks. In a climate like ours, stocks are uncertain, yields are uncertain. So, you know, you have to manage your stocks, and you don't want to keep too much in stock. So, you know, probably keep 2 years, 2.5, still wine anyway, 2.5 years stock in stock with, you know, one in tank, one in bottle, with a half a year sort of in the sales process. So, you know, if you said, well, we must keep 3 years in stock, that's a lot of money tied up, and then you've got selling wines which are a little bit older. So price is a mechanism of keeping pace with demand and supply, really.
What about the sparkling wines? You know, most English sparkling wines I see are vintage sparkling wines.
Yeah.
We don't see a lot of non-vintage, and it seems crazy because the French say they do it to get consistency, yet we've got a worse climate than them.
Unfortunately, people get locked into this vintage problem, which is when you start growing, of course, your first wine is a vintage.
Yeah.
So what do? You release it as a non-vintage or release it as a vintage? No, you release it as a vintage because that's where people's perceptions of money lie. You know, they think a vintage wine is going to be more expensive.
Yeah.
And because once you're locked into that vintage cycle, you can't really get out of it. I don't really see it as a problem. I mean, Chapel Down, which is the market leader in terms of volume, you know, their non-vintage white probably outsells everything by a factor of 10. You know, that's non-vintage. It's not made from classic varieties. It's made from Müller, Reichenstein. I think there's a bit of Pinot Noir in it. very good product for the price. It's actually £17 I see now, which I think is getting up there a little bit.
Yeah, it's creeping up. Everything's creeping up quite a bit.
Everything's creeping up. Well, duty's gone up. Yeah. Cost of bottles have gone up. You know, yeah, things are going up.
Sure.
That's the same throughout the wine trade. We're not working in euros, of course, which virtually all the rest of the wine trade are.
Okay. Just getting back to your book. Obviously, it's how long has it been? 7 years? Eight? No, longer than
seven years. Well, really, eight years since the information was put in there, yeah.
Do you think you'll do another one in 8 years, or do you think?
Well, it's being published on a printing on demand, so it's published on Lulu, www.lulu.com, which is how I published my viticulture book.
Yep.
It's a very flexible system. I can update it virtually instantly, and so I'm hoping that I'll have 2008 will be this version. I'm hoping that I shall be able to update it every year.
Oh, lovely.
That's the plan.
Oh, good. So it's going to be more of a...
More topical, yeah. Updated every year with more new information, new vineyards, and keep the thing really up to date.
And lulu.com is the place to buy it, is it?
That's right. Yeah, that's the place to buy it.
Okay, and do you know what it's going to be selling for?
The current...
not enough?
I think 1995. I think that's the current price.
And it's quite a thick book. It's about 300 pages.
It'll be more than that. Yeah, it will be. I think it's probably over 400.
Really?
Yeah.
I've used it to dip into, and
I'm sure, yeah.
I've never read it cover to cover.
Oh, well, there you are. You should do.
I haven't got the time.
No.
It's a bit hard work. I find it more of a reference book.
Well, that's what it's for. Yeah, it's a reference book. Yeah, the front, the historical section, the last book won the André Simon Wine Book of the Year, so I have great hopes for this one might do the same thing.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
All right then, Steve.
Okay, Chris. Good to meet you.
Cheers, very much.
Good to speak to you. Thank you.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Stephen. Stephen talked about keeping the wines, particularly sparkling wines, being quite expensive because it ties the money up in stock. I've recently been drinking some Leventhal wines I purchased when I interviewed George Bowden from Leventhal near Leeds way back in show 48. To be honest, at the time, the wines to me were more of an oddity, but they're all 2005 whites and they're starting to taste quite good and significantly better for their time in bottle. So maybe some of these English white wines could do with a bit of aging. Next week, we change tact a bit. I'm going to be talking to Tony Sharley from Banrock Station. Banrock are owned by Constellation, and hopefully they're not one of the wineries that are going to be sold off, as we heard of in the news. But we talked with Tony about a number of issues, but the key issue for me is Tetra Pak. Banrock have been producing wines in Tetra Pak for the Australian market for a number of years, and we talked to Tony about this and his take on this new packaging. But before we finish the show this week, a quote, this time from Alexandre Dumas, the author of The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers. He said, wine, the intellectual part of the meal. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.